comment about what he had to say this morning, and then I'll leave it quickly because I also feel the pressure of time this morning. But
remember Hosea?
It seems to me that what he has said is that Hosea has seen the Old Testament covenant as really being an option, because an option is an offer which is not revocable, while Jeremiah sees the covenant as an option which is not revocable, as Hosea. Jeremiah sees it as being an offer, because an offer is something which the offeror can at his own wish and without hindrance simply revoke. In both an option and an offer, as we use those words in our modern language, both contain a promise. I promise, I offer. I promise that I will do this for you. It's usually the prelude to a relationship between parties, which may be, in our contractual terms, either a unilateral or a bilateral arrangement. But both the option and the offer contain the promise of the offeror. The offeror is the one who always initiates the transaction. He is the man who seeks out the other person and says, I want to do business with you. And he makes the proposal in terms of a promise. When it's an option, it's irrevocable as offer, either because he has received consideration from it, from the person with whom he offers, or because the offeror, God, has bound himself in a deed poll, unilateral, under seal, irrevocable. Now, anytime that you like the rest of that, enroll in the University of Washington School of Law, take the course in contracts, and in no less than 90 class hours, I will explain that concept to you. My role this morning is to try finally and level with you on what I've been hinting at and playing around with all week. How to settle an argument with your neighbor is the thing that I want to talk to you about this morning. How to resolve these problems that come into your life. See, how to resolve the relationship of you and anybody else. Now this argument, this conflict, this disagreement, maybe over whose dog killed your chickens, where the boundary line is to your property, the fact that he has alienated the affections of your wife, anything. This is a multi-purpose, good for all things. How to settle an argument with your neighbor. And I have put here 4 points, and I'll try to make these 4 points make sense. Because you see, as a lawyer, and therefore, whether lawyers like it or not, as a theologian, although we don't get much training in theology, I must start with theology. We must recognize, first of all, that sin is alienation and not the violation of laws. Try to make that clear in a moment. 2, we must understand this theory of cognitive balance or cognitive dissonance that I've been talking to you about. What it is that God does for man and how it works. 3, we must understand that law, the method, the technique of law, the way of living together that we call law, not the rules, but the law as a method, that law is the good gift of a rejected suitor who still loves. And 4, you must see yourself as Christ. I told Jane, just when Dr. Wolf stopped, that I'm going to say precisely the same thing to you this morning that he said last hour, only not nearly half so eloquently. Just much more understandable. It's sometimes very, very difficult for a man of Dr. Wolf's brilliance, and I say this seriously, with no intent of flattery. Flattery is not my cup of tea. It's very difficult for a man who understands something as well as he understands what he's just been talking about to make us understand it, you see, because his own insights run over him. Sometimes, you know, it's said that a good teacher is a guy who is just barely one step ahead of the students. And you have to work just as hard as they do. And I find in my own teaching as a practical matter that the problem that I've wrestled with longer and harder, that I've really sweat over, you see, is the one that maybe the students understand too, because it's that tough. Recognize that sin is alienation. We have almost buried the artifact that we're after here. We've almost buried the idea of Christianity. I'm using Dr. Wolf's talk to us the other night with the slides about getting things out of the caves. That precious artifact down there in the bottom of the cave, we've almost buried it beneath yards of bat guano and sheep dung, because we poured it on. Every guy who's flitted in and looked at this problem and not understood it has left a little excrement and flitted out again. People have simply been unable to see the fact that sin is nothing except the separation from God. They have insisted that it is things like robbing banks and seducing women and smoking tobacco. And these errors, these serious misunderstandings, have built up and built up and built up and encrusted until we no longer are able to understand, or just barely able to dig out. We are almost suffocated in a cloud of bat dung when we get into the church and try to see sin as just pure alienation from God. So bad has this problem become in our church that there are actually people who think that Jesus Christ was killed and suffered physical agony on a cross. And we miss the whole picture, you see. Because Jesus Christ did not suffer biologically, physically, very much. He died a very easy death, physically. There were thousands of men crucified, and almost every one of them lasted a lot longer time than he did, and suffered a lot more than he did. Jesus' agony was in the alienation. It's easy to be a hero and die a martyr's death if you got a Congressional Medal of Honor just around the corner. I have seen a lot of men die under circumstances much more painful than that Jesus experienced. But if, when you have done everything right, instead of getting the Congressional Medal of Honor, you get stabbed in the back by your own father, then you begin to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And this is real agony, you see, to know the totality of all the loneliness and all of the alienation and all of the disappointment and all of the complete estrangement, all of the hatred of the world heaped onto one guy, an innocent guy at this. Innocent not in terms of law. To have all of that heaped on him, so that he becomes so repulsive that the whole world just quakes in revulsion. Now that man, who has been double-crossed in the very worst sort of a way, and who has been totally alienated, and now sees his abandonment, finally, by his own father, and he still loves, and commits himself into the hands of his lover, and says, thy will be done. I commit myself to you. There is the kind of love, you see, without any expectation of compensation. Now that's not an easy thing to see. And as soon as you start pouring it on and saying that there is sin in terms of misdeeds rather than alienation, you miss the whole point. How did Christ become sin? Christ became sin by being alienated. How did he manifest love? By accepting that alienation and loving still. There's the mirror. Now, if you've seen that, and I beat myself one whole day, and I've had a tremendous amount of assistance from everybody else around here this week. not in beating me, but in trying to demonstrate this idea of alienation. If you get that point, then you're ready for action. You've got to understand, and we went through this with beautiful cognitive dissonance diagrams. You've got to see that God's way of handling this problem is to throw us off balance by the unmerited, undeserved, unanticipated, unforeseen, unpredictable, completely shocking gift of love. He just literally shocks the hell out of me. That's what cognitive dissonance means. That's what heaping coals of fire on the head means in chapter 12. When God saw man deliberately alienate himself from the unity that man had as the created person, the image of God, that unity, when God saw man deliberately alienate himself and say, I reject the relationship which you have given me, I hereby elect to exercise the power to alienate myself from you that I have, as being a person created in the Spirit of God and having the freedom to alienate myself. Then God's response at this point should have been, all right. If that's the way it is to be, that's the way it is to be. If we're going to do it this way, then the just thing to do is to punish you. Instead, God elected to withhold his wrath. This is a terribly startling thing. It's completely upsetting. It's completely without being foreseen, and therefore causes me, in my great discomfort at not being able to put together the proper expectation and the observed fact, because these things are different, because I was perfectly convinced that it was bark. That's my whole perception, that God was going to punish me fairly and justly because I had broken the law, because I had broken the law. That God was going to punish me because I had elected to alienate myself. This is the only perception of this thing that I can have, is that it's bark. But now I see conclusively by the scientific evidence of analysis that it is plastic. I cannot lie to myself and say that that's bark when I know it's plastic. Therefore, looking at this authority, and the authority here, my friends, as I tried 1.5 hour to explain, is always that ultimate love of God with which you cannot argue. Once you see it, there is no argument. Beauty cannot be denied. You may not see it, but if you see it, if you look, you cannot deny it. You may not look at the laboratory results. You may not take the bark into the laboratory to have it analyzed. But if you do, and if you see it, you cannot deny it. Because no man can lie to himself. You can lie to other people, but you can't deny what you know. That's cognitive dissonance. That's what happened there. And I'm going as fast as I can because I want to subject myself to cross-examination. Then if you understand what it is that God does, what is the power of God? What is the power of God? Cognitive dissonance. Absolute love that keeps pouring on. If you understand that, then you're ready for this next one. God didn't punish man by giving him law. It wasn't the purpose of God to try and destroy man by law. God didn't give man rules so that man might get tricked into breaking those rules and thus get slapped down. He didn't need that. The alienation was already there. There would be no useful purpose in setting up rules at this point to try and punish you for petty larceny when you were already guilty of 5 kinds of murder. The law that came to man after the alienation of God and man was pure love. Nothing in the world other than that. Man was now in a situation where he couldn't live. Man was a wild beast, having been alienated from the only thing which made him rational and sane, the only thing that made it possible for him to live. Can you see that? Man was living in an impossible situation. He was like the Dutchman sailing on the sea, who could never live and could never die. Man was cursed with the terrible, terrible curse of being unable to escape this eternal separation from God. Now, if God were not like God, if God were not absolute love, but if God were going to act now in justice, God would have said, "All right, brother, there you are. I needn't do anything more. It's your fat, swim in it." And that would have been hell enough for anybody. But instead of speaking even partially in anger, but speaking fully in love, God said, "No, I give you blessings that you can't even imagine. I'll even let you die, biologically." Isn't going to be easy. It isn't going to be sweet or pleasant. But this also, you see, is a blessing. I'm now going to give you a way of existing while we try and work out a reunification. So those gifts took many forms. They took the form of food that a man can eat and preserve biological existence, and water which a man can drink and preserve his biological existence. And it took the form of rules, which rules are good enough so that a man can live with another man, if they do not live in anarchy, but if they live in some kind of an orderly package, so that every time I disagree with you, I don't have to take my sword out and try to cut you in half. Because that's the way that man started. It's the way that man lives if he doesn't have some concept of law. He wages his battle. Law is a good gift to make life possible in an ordered society. But it's an inferior thing. It's an inferior relationship. It's a poor substitute for the kind of relationship that exists between people who don't have to live with respect to each other according to the law. Because, and now we get a very fundamental difference in here. Love, the relationship of two people who relate to each other in a love relationship, is, we describe it always as being an I-thou relationship. You and I. God and I. Where we can sit down together and we can say, "What can I do for you?" Where there is no conflict possible. Now, I can't give you a picture of this in human life because one doesn't exist. But I can give you one that's almost like that, of the very best kind of a relationship that exists between two human beings. Parent, child, husband, wife, friend, friend, whatever it may be, in your experience. Some of us have had experiences with one kind of a person that form a closer bond with that person, man or woman, than anyone else we've ever known in our life. Think of the best relationship that you've ever had, with whomever it may have been. Can you see yourself deliberately overreaching that person? Can you see yourself struggling for advantage in trying to cheat and defraud and deal under the table and take something away from them? Can you see that person when there has been a misapprehension of the relationship between the two of you? Can you see that person in trying to cheat you? Has there ever been an experience in your life where you knew someone so well, so intimately, where you loved them so sincerely, that that person can have absolutely anything I possess, my money, my car, my house, my life, even my brownie button, anything. I completely trust this person because I am utterly convinced that anything that person does is going to be that person's very best judgment of what will be good for me. And if I have this kind of relationship, I will relate to that person in exactly the same way. Never would I think of trying to steal my wife's brownie button. I just wouldn't do it, you see. I don't care how much it hurts me to give it up. I will gladly, willingly, lovingly make this contribution to this person with whom I have this relationship. That's the relationship of love. But God is so much of a lover that he won't insist. This is a man, a strong man, who loves a young lady, and she doesn't reflect his love. He is convinced in his whole being that if she loves him, that they will have a splendid relationship. And she doesn't see it that way. And let's just say for a moment the improbable thing that he is right and she's wrong. I just assumed that for a moment. Now the question becomes, if he is right, and if she is seeing this inaccurately, so that it would be a good thing if those two people were united together, why doesn't he grab her by the neck and say, "Love me? Love me or I'll kill you." Because, you see, it can't be done. To do that to her is to violate her very person as a lover. You can rape a person, but you can't force them to love you, you see? This has to be a relationship that's entered into willingly, if the other person is also of the Spirit of God. If the other person is also human. Well, you can condition a dog, and you can condition a human being to jump every time you blow a whistle, or a lot of other things. I was telling some of you at dinner last night about Professor Skinner. It's worth taking the moment to talk about it. Professor Skinner is the man who developed the theory of operant conditioning. He's the guy who teaches pigeons when to peck at symbols and stuff. He uses rewards and punishments. When you do the thing that somebody wants you to do, you get a reward. When you do something they don't want you to do, you get a punishment. And pretty soon, just instinctively, you go over and do what you want to. Professor Skinner's students recently got together and put their heads together, and they agreed that when Professor Skinner came in to lecture, that when he was over in that corner of the room, they would all sit up and take notes and laugh at his jokes and all these other rewards. And as he strayed from that corner, if he ever got over here, they'd go to sleep on him. Inside of a couple days, Skinner was plastered in that corner. And he never knew what hit him. Now, these forces are available to us, but you can't do it by slugging. God will not violate your human personality. He will not. God will not deal with you falsely. He will not ram it down your throat, because that is destructive of the very relationship that you want. Is that understood? Why doesn't he buy it? Why doesn't God say to me, "Look, love me, and I'll give you $50. Not enough, $100. Love me. I'll give you Holden Village. Love me. I'll give you food when you're hungry. Love me. I'll give you water. Love me. I'll rescue you from dangers." Inducements. God wants a lover, not a prostitute. You can't buy that relationship. You can't force it. You can't buy it. And God has offered it freely, and he will not revoke, because it's an option. Hosea, you see, is clearly right. I haven't read Romans 11 yet, but if I have to rewrite it, I will. It's clearly right, you see. God will not violate man's personality. So then, God says to man, "Look, you realize that we're alienated. I don't care whether or not you continue to rob banks. I don't care about that. My love comes to you anyway. I continue offering you the power of my transforming power, my converting." Look and accept, you see, at this cognitive dissonance that I offer you so freely. Simply look at it, and you will love, because no man can deny that authority. It isn't that he's compelled to, it's just that you can't deny it, you see, if you see it. It isn't compulsion in any sense. It's simply a recognition of the fact. But I won't force it down your throat. Nor will I punish. Nor will I beat you. You live in alienation already. It's nothing worse than that. Rather, instead of punishing, I will continue to heap gifts, including law, because this makes it possible for me to live with God and God with me. Is that understood? Now, how do I get that down, finally, to settling a grievance that I have with my neighbor? Well, this is very simple, by the fourth point. I'm Christ. Glad that I have the authority of Dr. Wolf. I had a little difficulty with my wife on this point last night. And she doesn't see me that way. Nonetheless, it's true that as a redeemed, a reunited person who lives in Christ and Christ in me, I have the same power and I have the same love, and I am a little Jesus, and I can offer you the same healing love that Christ did. Well, not by going around telling you about it, for pity's sakes. Not if it just comes out of my mouth, just words. But if I can love you the way Christ loved me, the way Christ loved even though he was totally rejected, and boy, I'm going to jump on that point and insist on it. You've got to be able to love that man Speck in Chicago. You've got to love that man. Because if you don't love that man, there is no chance that he is ever going to know the love of God in the world. You're the one that's got to love him. Now, we don't like that very well, because we think God sure blew it when he went back to heaven and left that kind of a obligation in your hands. You're so thoroughly convinced that God blew it, that he set up a poor structure, that he didn't know how to organize a church or run the show, that you keep telling him, now look, God, all we have to do is get organized here. Let's set up a few restrictions and a few regulations. Let's lay it out in the code book. Let's take care of these problems. Let's have it in the rule book like this, so we all know where we stand and nobody steps on anybody else's toes, and we'll get along just straight. You're so busy telling God how to set up his church that you don't even listen to what he's got to say. God says you get out there and you love Speck. You love him. You love the man that stole your billfold. You better. That's the relationship that there must be. You love those lazy, no good, shiftless bums. All of them. I currently have on appeal a case that I just managed to lose in the trial court. I lose more than I win. This one I've told some of you about. Forgive me for repeating it. It's important as an illustration. My client, a man by the name of Wayne Jacob Hill, has just been convicted for the 98th time in 17 years of public intoxication. He is a chronic, addictive alcoholic. I almost alienated my whole family when I agreed to represent a chronic, addictive alcoholic. And when they found out that the bill was being paid, not my salary, I'm working without a fee, but when they found out that the costs of filing fees and this sort of thing was being paid by the American Civil Liberties Union, I did alienate some of them. Because society looks at Wayne Jacob Hill and says to him, you're getting just exactly what you deserve. In prison you go. When I put Mr. Hill on the stand, and incidentally I never met him before the day that I walked into the courtroom, because it isn't so much Wayne Jacob Hill as a one single human being, although I love him as a single human being, but it's
an idea here. When I put him on the stand and I asked Mr. Hill, where do you live? He said, the county jail. Because this man has literally been in the county jail more than he's been out. When he is flushed out of the county jail, after he's dried out, shoved back into the only environment in which he can live, an environment where everyone drinks. It's the only way they share and know any companionship at all, because you have totally rejected him, and you wouldn't let him in your church from Sunday morning if he showed up. Maybe I'm being too harsh, but I doubt it. Because we have totally rejected him, and because we've told him he's getting just exactly what he deserves, because you won't have anything to do with him, because he's a filthy man, because he gets drunk and vomits, because he's a very unpleasant guy. But you don't like him. I thank Paul Gabrielson this morning for telling me the difference between liking a man and loving him. I don't like Wayne Jacob Hill. He's a drunken bum. How I love that man. And you've got to love him too. Society doesn't really have a right to take a Wayne Jacob Hill and 98 times throw him into prison and never once offer him a scrap of love. How do they expect to redeem that man? Just by punishment, without any love. You see, love is a person-to-person thing that cannot be forced. But if the loved person will not accept that love, if I refuse to look at the laboratory reports, if I will not see that that which appears to be bark is in fact plastic, if I will not see that, then some other relationship must exist between us, because I will not have it. And you will not force me. I will not have God, and he will not force me, nor will he buy me. Not in the sense of rape or prostitution. That is not the relationship that exists between me and God. Then what? Well, then we live according to the rules. And as soon as you live according to the rules, you take your grievance, and he takes his grievance, and rather than discussing it in love with each other, we put it to the judge. And we introduce between us an insulating quality that keeps us from each other's throats, so that we will not kill each other, and it also keeps us from each other's hearts. If I will never act for you, if I will never express by my very life the love which I feel for you, so that you will never see it, you will never know what God's grace is. It's just exactly that simple. Now, is it possible for one dealing with his repulsive neighbor over here, who is suffering under the misapprehension that his property runs 10 feet over into my garden, is it possible for me to relate to this neighbor as Christ and love him, even while I take him down to the courthouse and make him prove, or I'll try to disprove, his claims in court? Yes. Because love and law are not mutually exclusive. They are different. They are totally different. Law isn't a kind of love, and love isn't a kind of law. They are two different things. Love is never judgmental. Love never says to Wayne Jacob Hill, you dirty bum, you're getting what you deserve. Go suffer. Never. Law can never really say, as law, not unless you get the crooked judge who wants to pervert the rule and exercise some mercy by stepping out of his judicial role, thereby warping Dickens out of the legal maneuver and making it impossible to predict where he goes next, and destroying the utility of the legal system. See, every time a judge bends justice to accommodate the screaming need of the individual, he makes the rule just that much less certain. It's destructive of the rule as rule. I'm not arguing for absolute technical crushing of every man that walks into the courtroom. Of course I'm not. I'm arguing for a more useful kind of a law, one which is built sensitively to the needs that we're serving. I would argue, as I will argue in a month or two in the Supreme Court of the State of Washington, that the law dealing with public intoxication of chronic addictive alcoholics ought to be useful. Because the law is there to serve man. Man is not there to serve the law. Sabbath is for man, not man for the Sabbath. You do not worship a loaf of bread. It'll never get you to heaven. You don't worship a glass of water, and you don't worship a rule. I don't care what rule. Don't you make that your God. It cannot reunite you. It cannot overcome that alienation. Do you understand that? All right, you master the rule. You make the rule work for you. And if the rule, as it set out, is destructive, if it perpetuates Wayne Jacob Hill in his suffering and does no good to rehabilitate him, get rid of it. It's an abomination. It's hypocrisy. It's a hideous, monstrous thing that is there because of your hatred of that man, because you don't like him. And that's all. You want to see him suffer. And that's all. Oh, but the law is useful. It is a good gift of God. The law is there to help preserve order when people cannot otherwise live together. Just don't mistake it for God. Now it's possible for me to say to a man, I love you. I want to live in peace with you. And insofar as it is possible, I will live in peace insofar as it is possible or depends upon me. Last night, chapel. I will live in peace with you. But if he flatly says, no, you will not, I can't go back to God and say, God, let's change the pattern now. Give me the authority to love this man by splitting him in two with an axe. It just won't work. I've been through that. You understand that? What do I do, God? God says, it's simple. Do what I do. Continue loving the man and give him good gifts. And one of those gifts shall be social order. Law. The method. The rule with utility. And the rule with utility is to be used constructively always and never in hate, never to destroy, but always to love. One very simple illustration of that, and then I'm serious about it, I'll stop, although I'd rather talk for another 6 hours until some of that fog disappears out there. But I have one more illustration, and then I'll stop and let you ask questions, and maybe you can dispel the fog faster than I. You know, there's a saying that we have in law school about law school teachers. They are like out on the coast where the shipping goes by in the Pacific Ocean. We have these towers with bells and fog horns that whistle out there. And the story is that somebody asked the Indian one day, what is that? The sidewalk Indian sitting out there. This guy must have been from Iowa or something like that. And he looked at this building, what is that? The Indian says, that's a fog horn, but he's no good. He whistle, he blow, he ring bells, flashlight, fog comes in. And I'm not at all sure that I can dispel for you the fog, no matter how much I blow and whistle and flash. But I got one more jewel, and then you can cross-examine. In our use of this final desperate poverty measure, simply to preserve order so that we don't kill each other, when we must finally, because of the rejection of the man with whom we would live in peace, when he finally rejects and will not accept us, and we can go on unilaterally loving him and giving him good gifts, even though he will not respond to our love any more than we respond to God's love if we reject him, and elect to live in a law relationship under the rules with God rather than as his child, rather than as being God, being Christ, living in this relationship, we reject him. Then what? Well, even there, you continue pouring on the love, and let me demonstrate how. One of the things that law, straight, strict, legal, technical law, cannot do
is to ask a person to do any more than is absolutely minimally necessary. Because every invasion of freedom is destructive of a human being. You get to think about that, but you have to think on your own time. Christ illustrated it first, you see, when he refuses to illustrate my freedom. When he gives me absolute freedom, even to deny God. Every invasion, every use of law that invades a man's freedom of choice is destructive of that person. It hurts him. You, sir, yesterday were my hero. You finally decided what we were going to do with those people down in the cavern. The only guy with real guts around here. And he knew when he was doing it, when he was being the judge and resorting to law, he knew that he was sentencing a man to death and hurting him, and that's wrong and it hurts. But he knows that he's not in a situation where you can avoid that. You see, he's Martin Luther all over at this point, where he's willing to be in error but act because God's grace is sufficient. You cannot demand that a man do things which are beyond his capacity. If you try to demand legally that a person do something which is beyond his capacity, he can't do it, and that's perfectly obvious. And therefore, you have a situation as a straight legal problem. Well, what in thunder are you going to do now? When you have demanded that legally that he do something that he can't do, how are you going to handle that situation when he shows up loser as? Of course he must be. Oh, the law's in a sad bind at this place. It either has to railroad and run over this guy and crush him for something which is not his responsibility even legally, which is pretty rough. It's pretty rough to kill a man or to sentence him for something that he really couldn't avoid doing. Up until about 70 or 80 years ago, we were torturing people because they were epileptics. He couldn't help it, but if they had a seizure out in the street, we decided we better burn him a bit, put him in prison a bit for behaving like that. By God, we'd punish the devil out of them. Martin Luther in his table talk says, if a child is born handicapped, retarded child, drown it. Now, we've come a long way, not all the way. We still throw a chronic addictive alcoholic in prison and don't help him. That's not the way that God wants us to use this gift. Use it in love. Demand no more of that person than he can accomplish. That is acceptable to the minimum needs of society. The least invasion of his freedom that is demanded by the protection of society. Give him all the advantages. Give him all the benefits of the doubt, doing only what is minimally necessary. You want to help a person grow, you don't do it by punishment, by a rule. You do it rather the way a good father. Think now of a good relationship, will you? A father to a child, a mother to a child. You do it the way of a good, loving relationship between a parent and a child. A parent can expect and ask for more from the child than the child can accomplish and not be destructive of that child. Because the parent, the parental love, radiates to that child and says, I know you can do it. I know you can do it. Go on, give it a try. And if you fail, and when you're demanding more than the child can do, the child will fail. If you fail, I'll love you anyway. A parent can do that. A human being can do that for another human being, but a rule, a law, an objective thing cannot. When the person fails, you have your choice. Either destroy the utility of the law by messing it up, or punish him unjustly. Either make the prosecutor resort to a kind of unreasonable discretion as to who he's going to prosecute and who he is not. What cases you will sue on and what you won't. Destroy the fabric of the law or punish him unjustly. The law can't help itself. The law is not a loving thing. It has no grace and mercy and forgiveness. Do you understand that? But a relationship between two people does. Therefore, conclusion. You as Christ, a converted and redeemed human being with the Spirit of God in you, have that same Christ-like capacity that Christ has. You can radiate by expressing your love by your life and by your activity to another person. You can radiate all of that cognitive dissonance stream of converting power to another human being.
can't force him, and you can't buy him. If he looks at it, he will be converted by the love of God.
Its efficacy is unbelievable.
But if he will not look at the evidence, it won't work. What a man will not see and what he will not hear cannot change his life. And if he rejects, you keep loving him. But resort to the other pattern which God also follows, the pattern of rules, the pattern of orderly living with this person, preserving him in love by a gift of law, of rule, which is used as kindly, as humanely, as with as little abrasion in his life as possible. Now, cross-examine. Sir?
Yeah, I have a question. It's rather long.
Well, you're entitled to it, believe me.
Okay, it deals slightly with number one, but in a subject such as mathematics, you can't understand the calculus, but you understand the algebra. And in Christianity, I have a little trouble with the counting system. And in that light, I'm asking a question to you. It might create some fall, but maybe release some personal fall. In this concept of sin, it's impossible for a person to sin against another person, my way of thinking. If the one who is the object of the sinning will not accept it as such, I believe that you agree that there are situations when a person has set out to hurt you, but you have been sympathetic to see their needs and not been able to even feel any resentment against their act.
The trick's in the definition. It really is. If you mean, is it possible for another man to violate another person's prerogatives, his rights, his law, his position, even though the other person assents to it? The answer is yes. There are types of relationships that are so destructive of societal patterns that even though you and I contract to do this thing, it's still legally an offense. It's adultery by marriage, a bigamous marriage. We both consent. Homosexuality, consenting adults. Everybody consents. It is still destructive. And as the law has now stated, still a crime. If, on the other hand, you are talking about sin as alienation, this is never behavioral. Sin is never what you do. Sin is status. It's what you are. The other morning, I don't remember whether you were here or not, but the other morning I was trying to explain this by saying, to be a sinner is like being a dog. It's a status. It's a thing that you are. It isn't behavioral. Dogs behave in certain ways, most dogs. Some dogs bark, some chase squirrels, some do other things. Not all of them do the same things. Those are behavioral problems. And if the dog rips your pants legs, that's a bad dog. But it's a dog. To be alienated or to be united with Christ is a matter of your condition, your status, how you are. Doing what you do or not doing what you don't do is a matter of your behavior. Sin is always a condition. Law is always behavior.
Yes. Okay, now I was just prefacing
my
question.
Oh, I'm sorry. And you warned me, too.
I'll consider this, but I have to ask a question right now. I agree with what you said. But what I'm saying is that on a person-to-person relationship now, we can't... Well, let me ask, I have to ask another question that I forgot. Can you sin against a person? No more question than that, just can sin against a person.
The difficulty is in the question, and we've got to go through the definition again of can I sin against the person. And the way that I've just defined it, no, that's an impossibility. Because you're asking me whether my behavior is sinful, and the result is no. I mean, the answer is no. This is a condition. If I do not love him, I am in sin. I am sinful.
Now, to clarify what I'm asking, I'm going to substitute another word. I'm going to substitute wrong for relationships between people. Substitute sin, use sin for man against God, for God and man relationship. Wrong.
I can remain alienated from God, and that is, quote, wrong in the stated sense. It is not good in the sense of being united.
This, now then, is the question. If a person can never say to another, you can never make another person say to you, you've wronged me, simply because that person has so much feeling for you. How can a loving God say, you've sinned against me? Because to me, sin is a concept of hate, and only a hateful person can say to another person, you've wronged me.
Yeah, that's...
How can a loving God, therefore, say, use a word which I associate with hate, and say to people he doesn't love, you've sinned against me?
That's a question which can be best asked by a man who has been buried beneath 8 feet of bat dung, by being told constantly that the relationship between man and God is a relationship of behavior against God, which is in violation of God's rules, and therefore is sinful, and therefore God hates you, and therefore God will punish you. Down beneath all of that sheep manure is the precious artifact, which is God never has hated you, and he never will. God has always loved you no matter what your behavior. You're still a dog no matter how much you refuse to chase squirrels. Now, it is true, you see, that if you reject God's love and remain in alienation, you remain what you are. But if you will simply accept this thing, accept this evidence, this cognitive dissonance evidence, God will literally transform you. He will literally convert you by adoption. Adoption is not hard for us to understand. There's a person who is not my child. And I whip up the right papers. Look out now. I whip up the right papers and I take them into the judge and say, sign here, and the judge signs there. That person is my child. Now, because this person happens to be over 14. Because that person happens to be over 14 and we are in the state of Washington, that person is going to have to consent, or else legally I cannot adopt. So I come up with my paper, with the petition, with the judge, and I say, I now want to bestow upon you my total wealth, but let you inherit everything that I have, make you a Ricky. Other than marriage, I have one of those already. I want to adopt you. Will you be adopted by me? Will you accept this status, this relationship with me? And she says, no. That blows it. So I can't do it. Now, if she says yes, the fact that I find out that she smokes and chews makes no difference. That's a behavioral problem. I may be sorry. She may be ruining my carpeting, but she is still my daughter. That's the difference between sin as alienation and sin as wrongs of specific acts, which is a law problem.
I'd like to rephrase this last time, and that is, who created the concept of God? Did the devil say that God, you will say that the people have sinned against you, or did God create the concept of sin? And if so, where did a loving God create a hateful concept?
Where did all this bad dung come from? It came from us. We're quite unwilling to accept God's love. We have looked at it and said, I don't believe it. Is a trigger in this someplace? I don't want it. I reject it. Who do you think you're talking to, God? You know who I am? I also am an indestructible spirit. I also am in the spirit of God. Don't you forget who I am, God. I'm your equal. I will rebel, and you will have your rights, and I will have mine. This is insubordination. It's alienation of that unity of one person, man and God, and I did it. I was born handicapped. I was born in alienation, because my forebearers had alienated themselves from God. I was born in sin. I was not born robbing banks. I was born with a status of alienation, and that's because of me and my alienation, not God. I created it. And I can create, you see, because I am Christ. Or I am a human being when I am not in that relationship and I have creative powers. I'm not a dog, really. I'm not a rock or a tree. I am a creator. I have that unlimited capacity to exercise a freedom which is so great that I can look at the creator of all the universe and say to him, drop dead. I can't. I can reject God. Have you ever thought of that power? And God says, what's more, I won't take it away from you. I don't care how much it's for your own good. I simply will not violate your humanity. I will leave you. I will neither rape nor prostitute. You will either be my lover or we will not be lovers. That's about the best I can say, I guess. Yes, sir?
Is sin technically a legal concept?
Sin is no. Short answer. Sin, no, I do not think it is. I think sin is a theological concept.
Yes, and therefore there are two sets of relationships which have to be divided when you're talking about civil.
Right.
Sin.
Right. There is sin, theological. There is a commission of a misdemeanor or a felony or a violation of an ordinance, legal. And these are totally different things.
American law would never use the term sin.
Oh, American law is just as sloppy as the American theologians. They waddle all over the place. You see judges talking about this man's great sin, in that he robbed a bank, baloney. Just plain sloppy legal language. Not all lawyers are geniuses. Yes, sir.
This is going back to Greg's question. I am curious to know the two concepts here that I think he was questioning. Would be this: does God exist and does sin exist? Is that right, Greg?
No, only the latter.
Does sin exist? Well, I've got to ask the first. If God does not exist, sin does not exist.
That's only one half of it.
If God does exist, sin does exist. Yes, sir. Because you see, a man can be alienated. Now, I immediately say again, that doesn't mean that God's going to rush in with a paddle and put me in jail for violating the statute, because that's not sin. God will look at me and say, Vern, I love you. I love you as much now as I ever did love you. And I will go on irrevocably loving you. But if you will not accept me, then we are alienated. You are a complete stranger to me. I'm sorry. And I am indeed like Christ on the cross, knowing what it is to be totally estranged, abandoned.
I'd like to say something that I asked a question.
That means you don't want an answer from me, all right?
This leads for all other arguments. It becomes involved now in a theological argument where one side says one and the other side says the other, namely this.
Yep.
If I say, if I accept your analogy,
if you want me to prove that God exists, you're talking to the wrong man. I can't do that. I believe it.
Well, it seems everything all is boiled down to a question of accepting things without...
It's a matter of faith.
Your question always is how you know.
That's right. It's a matter of faith. It's God's conviction that works in my heart. I can see many things in this world. I can see trees and the heavens and the firmament, and they declare the glory. They give me the statutes, and I see how the sun works, and I see his order. But beyond that, I can't see sin. I can only believe this and feel it. I can only sense that I am estranged. And I can only feel the conviction that comes with being reunited.
What I was trying to say was that if sin is a necessary consequence of our being created, that is, that we can live eternally or die eternally.
It's not. It wasn't necessary. Were simply a possibility, and man opted. And then instead of being punished, God gave an offer, an option.
I like one quote from Kierkegaard here because it's a magnificent one. He's on safe ground making it. He said, if there's a concept of sin and paganism, I would cease to be a Christian.
Well, I'd buy that. I think that fits. I will take your question in just a moment. It is 10:20, and I suspect that people are pouring coffee, and all Norwegians and Swedes can bail out. Germans who have a headache, who will stop and argue some more.
Well, maybe if everybody's going to move, this is a major question. I couldn't forget about it.
All right. If you feel like going on over at this point, please do. You're